Well, that was just kind of thrown in for fun.
Thank you.
I'm going on to do more of this kind of thing, and then I will be taking pictures through telescopes too. And then put these two things together in the contrast, the smallest that God has made, the largest, and show the similarities and the beauty. And then another part of it is another set of contrasts, which are beginning and end. Deals with seeds and dead stumps, and with birth and death, and reproduction and decay, and, you know, in contrast. And then the third set of contrasts, which will be the worst and the best. I put myself through this kind of thing a long time ago in college, when I thought that education wasn't making much sense, and that it didn't really have any guidelines or any compass points. It's kind of a round smorgasbord table of some kind, and you grab something coming off. And I stopped my education for a little while, you know, with the cooperation of a couple of professors who were willing to go along with it, and who said, all right, try it, you know, it sounds kind of interesting. And I said I had to have some compass points. And I asked them why in the world they didn't tell you something about what everything's all about before you get started getting educated. And so they set it up so I could look through a microscope for a couple of weeks and meditate through a microscope, and meditate through a telescope for a couple of weeks, and then meditate watching kids born over at Cook County Hospital in Chicago for a while. And then and reading all this time about this stuff also. And then sitting hours on end while people did that difficult thing of dying. For some people, very difficult. Particularly one old man who had no friends or relatives, nobody ever came to see him, and he was dying all alone. And I think I learned more about death and some of its aspects by sitting there at Cook County with a man who never had any friends come to see him or any loved ones. The loneliness of it for him, the different kind of death than some that we've been talking about in this last week or two, where death is relationship and where death is life, and where death is birth. But this was death in this absence of relationship. And he was unconscious the whole 3 days that I sat there holding his wrist and feeling of his pulse, just to be conscious of a heartbeat, knowing that when that heartbeat stopped, this man would be dead. And then it came that time when it happened. It's a terrible moment of loneliness to even sit beside one who is that lonely, and to get sucked a little bit into the vortex of that loneliness. Well, I went back to school after those four things, and then the professor, particularly Dr. Junick, who was an anthropologist, said, well, how'd it go? Got it all settled out now? Can you go and study now? I thought I could. This has been a tremendous kind of an experience, a shaking kind of a thing. I was still dazed from it. But something still bugged me, and so after a while I said I wanted to be gone again. And he was wondering if it was getting to be a habit. So he asked, what's wrong now? And I said, well, we missed two dimensions. We were dealing in a kind of a horizontal plane, northeast, north and south and east and west. And there's another dimension here, and that is the worst and the best, the up and down dimension. And so they said, well, okay, if you're a Lutheran and you're Christian, I suppose you got to fuss around with such things. But then I tried to find what was the worst, and I spent a couple of days in the, among other things, in the tank. That's a it's a place where they throw alcoholics so they can vomit for a night. And well, that was bad, but I guess I figured it wasn't the worst, that these guys were victims of the worst, not so much the worst. And then I rode with the vice squad in Chicago, and I made some raids on houses that have bad reputations and dragged the screaming girls out, screaming and giggling and laughing, I suppose initially to make a show so that it got enough attention to advertise. Well, and I began to realize these weren't the worst. These were also victims. But I discovered a great deal of the worst that is in me. Partly because I'd never had anything but hostility towards drunks and abhorrence of prostitutes. And somehow or another forgotten that these were created in the image of God. Well, where do you find this worst? I think it's probably in the people who are insensitive to the agonies of others, or who use people, or whatever. I tried to find the worst on Skid Row in Chicago, and down around Halsted and Maxwell Street area at that time, slum. And while looking for the worst, found some of the best, when some little kids accepted me and let me play jacks with them on the steps of a tenement house. As we played jacks until the mother came out wondering what this queer was doing, if you know what I'm talking about, with their kids. I had to be a pervert of some kind and a threat to them, because I wouldn't be sitting there with nice clothes on playing with their kids. Well, pretty soon the kids went to bat for me, and they said, no, he's a nice man. He tells us stories. And we'd been telling some stories. And... but that wasn't so bad. But when the old man got home, that was something. Because then it wasn't only the kids that were involved, but now it was the wife, and he wondered what in the world I was doing here. You know. And when she spoke up in my favor, she got some interesting back talk for a little while, too. But then after a while, he said, okay, mister, if the kids say you're all right, and my wife says you're all right, I guess that's good enough for me, and they accepted me, a stranger. And a stranger from a long ways off. I was from a suburb. Well, that, it was that same night that I'd already made plans for the best, and I was going to, you know, read good literature and listen to good music and spend a week in the Gospel according to John. And that particular night, and I just winding up my 2 or 3 week period in the poverty situation down there, and I left these kids and had to hurry over to Civic Opera House in Chicago. And these were depression years, but I'd managed to scrape up something like 25 cents so you could get a seat up in the last row up in the top balcony of Civic Opera House. And I got there late, and they were playing the Largo from the New World Symphony when I walked in, and that kind of got at me a little bit. And people thought it was strange that a guy would walk in off the street, come in late, have to walk in front of them while they were trying to listen to music, plop down the seat, and start to cry. But it was the only thing that was possible at the moment. Well, I've put a lot of people through this experience in varying lengths of times, up to most of a year, spreading out these times from a day in each of them to a week in each of them to a month or two in each of them. And it seems to have been valuable for others as it has for me. So I'm hoping to retire and start the University of the 7 Days, and the University of 7 Days will be for maximum about 20 people, you know, any one time, no more than that. 7 days are 1 day for each of these 6 things that I've said, the smallest and the largest, and whether the day is a month or a week or a day, it doesn't make much difference. But the smallest and the largest, the beginning and the end, and the worst and the best. The seventh day, that's the day for which all the rest of it is. And that's relationship. And when all of this thing can be brought together into the meaning of it all, which is relationship. Well, That's why I'm fooling around with taking pictures of urine and a few other things. And the next one will be the stars and some of that other stuff. And then those other sections of an outline for this stuff. Well, all right, we were talking about the way people get battered out of shape by reacting to the pains of their existence in certain very natural ways, which, if in extreme and unresolved, get people beaten up pretty badly. And three words emerge, you remember, and three words that are rather large ones, and they are hostility and guilt and fear. It's very hard to imagine anything more destructive entering into human existence than those three things. Hostility and guilt and fear. They account for so much of the agony and the anguish and so much of the destruction and so much of the immobilization of human beings. That they must be given great respect because of their damage. And yet some of them, you remember, start out by being good things. Just like pain is a good thing. If there's something wrong and you don't have the pain, you're missing a signal that can tell you that there's something wrong. Fear can be something good because it says something is wrong. You better do something about it. Hostility, I don't find any justification, or I just know that it is, and it's inescapable in human experience. But it's hard for me to really buy that it's a good thing. Guilt, that I can buy as a good thing, because that also comes as a warning signal, much like pain and like fear. It is a voice saying something is wrong. And leading us to do something, hopefully leading us to do something about it. If we could express our hostility, as we talked yesterday, if we could express the hostility but not feel the guilt over it, we would be seriously handicapped as human beings. Because we could go on expressing that hostility and never know how wrong it is and how destructive it is, both for the recipient and even more for the person delivering, expressing the hostility. But we recall that the law was given to man in two ways, in its codified form, in Ten Commandments on two tablets of stone to Moses, but that there was a prior way in which the law was given. At creation, God wrote an awareness of the law into the psyche of the human being. And human beings are aware that it is right to love, but it is wrong to hate. And that's the summary of the law, you understand. There's 10 commandments, and you can take those 10 commandments and subdivide them into 10 parts each or 100 parts each. Or, you know. But as you come back up, you come to two kinds of commandments. Thou shalt love God, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, which I suppose means you better love yourself so that you can do a decent job of loving your neighbor. I think that's what it means. Well, then, you summarize those two things, love God and love yourself so you can love your neighbor. Then you summarize that again and simply says, thou shalt love. And if you turn that one over, it says, don't hate. And that's what's in the heart of a man. It's part of our equipment. And we know that this is true. Well, hostility and guilt and fear. I suppose that it isn't hard to figure out that the opposite of hostility is love. While it's possible, and not only possible, it's probable that we hate everybody that we love. I guess that's almost axiomatic also. It's just the way in which we're incapable of perfect relationships or perfect love. And what's left over from the deficit there between what we're capable of in loving and perfection, that's got to be some kind of hostility. And two kinds, active and passive, of which the passive is the worst. The active hostility, at least people can put up some defenses against it, or fight back a little bit, or recognize it even. But the passive kind, that's very difficult to deal with, because you don't know it's there even. And the worst of that expression of that passive kind of hostility is when you can walk by a fellow human being and not know he's there. You don't even know him, don't even see him. Oh, you might physically see him, but you're not conscious of him as another human being. To be ignored is the worst thing that can happen to us. You're ignored by enough people, then you're like that man whose pulse I took for 3 days as he died in his separation and his loneliness. Reminds us a little bit of another one who is despised and forsaken of men. We had to probe even that agony, that aloneness, and that abandonment, in order that we don't have to take any path that somebody hasn't walked on before. But, having said that, say that the opposite of hostility is love, and when love moves in, hostility has to move over or move out. Or, if hostility moves in, the love moves over now. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be too awfully surprised if we find ourselves hating somebody we love, because this kind of ambivalence is just common to human experience. And I suppose it's a question of which one gets nurtured and increased, and which one gets reduced and conquered. Now, if you take a look at fear and look for its opposite, I suppose there'd be many words that you could use, but I think that the biblical word hope is probably the most accurate opposite of fear. Fear is a way of looking at the future, huh? It's an anticipation. It's a quality of anticipation of what's coming at you. The next person, the next day, or whatever. It is a stance and a posture in, or lack of it, in looking towards what's going to happen next or happen sometime. Now, you don't really fear in the present as much as you fear the future. Now, hope is a way of looking at the future. It's an attitude, a stance, a posture. It's an anticipation that no matter what happens, in the end, it will be good. Now, I don't mean that the things themselves will be good. But no matter what life may throw at us, if we live in this hope, which is the biblical concept of hope, we are living in a concept of and a commitment to an ultimate victory. An ultimate victory that rolls back into us in the now and isn't only to be some kind of a promissory note dated ahead to some resurrection, but in some way rolls in on us now, even this final victory. So, you can shout out with Paul, "Nothing shall be able to separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus my Lord." And it's that kind of an appropriate arrogance, which is the appropriate posture of a human being. And it spits in the eye of life's threats with an amazing kind of courage when that hope is dominant. Hard to leave out Sue and talk about these things, because to me, she showed that great courage and great contempt for death. Courage in the face of and contempt for it. So that she could say, well, take me home. Stop all this business of trying to keep me alive when everybody knows that it's not working and it isn't going to work. Let me come home so I can live until I die. Dying, yes, that she knew she was going to do. But she wanted to live until she died because she knew that she was going to live through her death and beyond. So you spit in the eye of the worst that life can throw at you. And if you can do that to death, then you're set free to live. Then, man alive, you know, you don't have to be so afraid of what log you step on up at Heart Lake. What if you do fall off, you know, and drown? Is that going to be so bad? You know.
Like we did.
Or, you know, if you don't have hope, you become some kind of a ravening coward that backs away and says, I got to save my life. Now, be careful now. Instead of having some kind of a sense of living life in abandon, with abandon, and almost a carelessness. I am not talking about irresponsibility now, and I'm not talking about eating too much like I do. You know, I'm not saying that. But neither am I saying that you ought to be so controlled in your life that you're doing everything to guarantee longevity. Holy smokes. What a life. You have to live life with a neurotic enslavement to making sure you get your square deal in the full measure of your 40 and 10 or whatever. 30 and 10, it's supposed to be. Yeah.
Some Fred, isn't hope a part of man's magical thinking?
I suppose it depends partly on what you hope.
Huh? And there isn't there
going
some
on
fear
there
associated with each kind of hope?
Fear associated with it.
Fear, for instance, that your hope will not be realized.
And now you're talking about the discrepancy between perfect hope and the kind we're capable of. Oh, I'm sure that's there. The doubts, for instance, can roll in. And are just as much a part, I'm sure, and I'm glad you bring this one up. I don't think I've thought of it that way, but there's something like the same ambivalence that we have in loving and hating. But I'm sure that there's an ebb and flow here. Turn over our hopes and you get some fear. Now it's a question of, does the hope grow or does the fear grow? Which one starts becoming the more and which one the less? Which one grows and which one shrivels? Without ever arriving at that place, I'm sure, where there's no fear that our hopes won't be. But that still allows then that the hope is the opposite of the fear, and that these two things are in tension and doing some battling. Who is it, somebody? Molly?
You put, I don't want to get one thing that means the words, but something that I know of as despair, would you put that in the same place as fear? Is that a form of fear?
I'm sure it is.
Like a fear of not living, but a kind of hopeless, maybe
about. Yes, and of ultimate failure. Even a failure of those things in which you've hoped or whatever, or that you formerly hoped in. This would kind of relate here. But I think we all go through despair also.
And that's a fear as far as you put it in the same basket as fear.
Yes, I think I would. But these things are not all that bad. I would guess that we grow more by dumping down into fear once in a while, or even despair. It gives us a place from which to jump into hope. Take a little look at that. It isn't quite as silly as it sounds. You've got to jump to something, huh? And I guess without our fears, we're not going to just reason out that the best deal that you can get in this existence is, to add everything up, is to commit yourself to Jesus. Now, because, you know, you add up a lot of things and it seems to come out best that way, it isn't that kind of a deal. You don't add it up and logically arrive at a balance and says, hey, this is better than the other. But someplace you come and you have to jump to something. And it's the nature of life to jump to some kind of a commitment, isn't it? You don't simply just grow your way into it. At least the people who seem to live with the fullness are people who have taken some kind of a jump, a leap. If not a leap of faith, for instance, a leap to faith, which I think is a more important leap. It ain't so hard to leap, take leaps of faith. But to leap to it in the first place, that's a hard one. Because it doesn't seem to make much sense. You can't add it up and come up with it. But it seems to me the times that we have the most energy for the jump is when we're afraid and when we're in despair. And I don't think it's such a bad thing to get down there and hit that kind of rock bottom and to find a place from which to jump to. Hope, let's say. And maybe every once in a while we have to kind of get on a bump again to remind us of some of the realities. There's another of these things now. If hostility and love are in some 180 degree relationship to each other, and if fear and hope are two diametrically different ways of looking at what is approaching. And we come to a third one. What's the opposite of guilt? Webster's got an answer for it. It says that it's innocence. But that's not a very good answer because it doesn't apply to anybody. It's an impractical goal. So there's no sense in getting all excited about that one. We're not going to be able to move away from guilt to innocence. But the difference between guilt, or the opposite of guilt, is forgiveness. You're either guilty or forgiven. You're not guilty or innocent. You're guilty or forgiven. I'm talking now as a human being, and I'm not talking about in some little incident of life where there may be guilt or innocence, of course. I'm talking now as a human being, and I'm not talking about in some little incident of life where there may be guilt or innocence, of course. But as a person, you are either guilty or you are forgiven. One of the two. There aren't any other possibilities. So, innocence isn't the opposite. Forgiveness may be spoken of as the opposite. But I would like to now play with words and stretch a little bit for something that's coming up. And say that, or we might say that forgiveness is the opposite of guilt. Forgiveness is found within the relationship with Jesus Christ. This is what happens when we are in the faith. There is no way in which we can be guilty if we are living in this faith. No way. Any feelings that you might have to the contrary are illusions, not reality. In this Christian church, for instance, we read, but let's change it and say, and be more accurate then, say it that way. In this faith, he daily and richly forgives me and all believers all our sins. I don't like even daily, because that's far too big a time span for this thing. Moment by moment, heartbeat by heartbeat, second by second, it's a continuous thing. We are forgiven in every moment. And when we go to confess tonight, when you put your head on the pillow, or whenever you do, or at whatever times, this is more an exercise in acknowledgement of our guiltiness than it is to purchase by an act a clearing of the books for this time period between this last confession and this present one. I don't want to live in any such hang-up, because I keep forgetting to confess. And what if I should die then, in some moment other than my moment of confession? That would be a horrible thing. I would die with some kind of a deficit, and as far as jumping to heaven is concerned, a miss is as good as a mile.
Since forgiveness is an assumption of guilt, and we're all guilty all the time.
Yes.
What, either imagined or real?
They're real. They're real. We need to be forgiven because we are guilty. Now, we imagine a few guilt, but the kinds that we imagine are usually the trivia. The real ones are the kinds of things in which we trod roughshod over our fellow man, or ignore his agony or his suffering or his plight or whatever. You get much more willing to face up to some kind of trivia than we do to this essential kind of an insensitivity to God and man. But surely to be forgiven is to acknowledge guilt. There's no sense in forgiveness otherwise. There's no meaning to forgiveness if there is not a guilt to be forgiven. And it's not the things that we do that constitute our guiltiness. It's the things that we are. I need to be forgiven for me. Not just for, because it is my nature even to ignore people and to be insensitive to their hurts. So it is more than simply the incidents and the episodes. There's something much more essential and much more central and much more elemental. If you'll allow me that little bit of stretching and reaching from guilt to the opposite of guilt is really found in our faith. It is our faith. In this faith we are forgiven. In this faith we are non-guilty. And it's kind of interesting that these three dirty words that we were talking about, that are both dirty and not dirty, they're both signals and destructive, depending on how they're dealt with and how they are handled and how they attack or are allowed to attack, and even their degree. Certainly the timing of their resolution. But then comes along Paul and says, after a lot of other fine words, he says, now abideth faith and hope and love. These three. And they relate significantly to these three great destructive factors in our life. And are the overcoming words or principles or experiences. But all of them based in love. Without the love, there would be no faith. wouldn't be that much to have faith in, because our faith is a faith in a person. A person who defines himself as love in the shortest definition. God is love. Well, think about it a little bit, huh? Because I think that the conclusion of what I was talking about yesterday and the day before will probably not take too long. I want to start off tonight by showing some slides that don't have anything to do with anything, okay?
All right.
Well, of course, they have something to do with something, but I mean nothing that we've been talking about. In fact, they're pictures of my urine. Now, if you didn't hear that, I can repeat it, but I hope it didn't. I have a kind of a hobby and philosophy and a few things. And I just want to introduce you to a little bit of this. Hank and I were talking about some of this on the way up the hill today, or up to Heart Lake. We had our conversations. Every time we got too winded to walk anymore, we stopped and then we'd and we'd talk a little bit. And we got too winded talking, then we'd walk. But we were saying that it's so easy when you come up to a place like this to look at the majesty of it and the bigness of it. Those enormous mountains, the big rocks, the big sky, and all of this. And perhaps we don't take enough time to look at the little things. I happen to be a hobby amateur photographer, and that's taught me a little bit about looking at things and seeing more than I knew was there. Partly because in a picture, and even when you put the camera up to your face, you frame a picture. And I think one of the secrets of life and living is to frame its pictures, whether these are, you know, actual photographs or paintings or something, or maybe those more important pictures that are, well, a day like we had today, Hank. You know, it's nice to put a frame around it and stop and remember it so that you can pull it back every once in a while and look at a day that was a good day and a beautiful day. And perhaps if we would outline our experiences a little bit more. And I think there are many ways to do that. One of them is by singing the doxology over them. It tends to frame them a little bit and fix them. Instead of just saying, oh, isn't that nice, and walking on, and then having a hard time pulling it back into consciousness at any time again. Well, this business of, you know, instead of taking a picture of a big waterfall, I like to lie on my belly and take a picture of a little waterfall and then make it look like a big waterfall. Because there are just as many little waterfalls that are lovely in this world as there are big waterfalls. And I suspect maybe the loveliest of all are little bits of ones that you know, you hardly even notice when you walk to Heart Lake. But a camera tugs at me a little bit and says, take a look.
That's the way Hollywood does it.
Yeah, I think so. But it helps to train us a little bit to see that there is far more beauty than what we're conscious of, simply because we don't stop to look at it. I remember once up in Alaska, my son became quite disgusted with me because he was in a hurry to get home. I think that he was missing his girlfriend. And Gertrude, don't take this too bad, but more than I was missing my wife. Or whatever. But you know how it is at that, you know, 19 years old age or whatever. But anyway, he came and found me lying on my tummy, eyeballing some tiny little leaves that were about, oh, maybe a quarter of an inch by 3/8 of an inch. And they came in two colors, and they determined the color of the hillsides. And just, there must have been zillions of these things. There were these tiny things, but they were just like a floor covering. They covered everything. And the whole mountainsides and the hills and valleys, everything was covered with these little leaves. Just the ground covering stuff. And when you really got down on your tummy and took a good look at them, particularly through some kind of magnifying lens, they were very, very beautiful. But God must have been almost foolishly extravagant that he put those around, because there are zillions of them, that most of which never get seen. Well, you get what I'm talking about a little bit. I like to contrast the small things and the large things. Like looking through a microscope and then turning right around and looking through a telescope to get the jolt of it. And to try to, and you have to meditate when you do this, because otherwise you miss the, you don't see any difference much. You know, because you can get pictures through a microscope that look about as much like some of the things in the stellar universe as the things in the stellar universe look like. It's an amazing kind of similarity. Now, somebody took some pictures of thinly sliced rocks up here a while ago, and under a certain technique. And when I came in with some pictures, they said, "Oh, you take rock pictures too." But I don't take rock pictures. I take pictures of urine. Sounds a little silly, doesn't it? Nah, that's an exaggeration. I do take some pictures of urine. You want to see what some looks like? What? What did you say, Andy? No, you have no choice. Obviously, you had no choice.
Let's see. We're
going to
have to.
Some of you may have to move a little bit to see.
We can't see.
Anyway, cut off some more lights here.
Yeah. Let's see. We're too high, huh?
Yeah, bad. Yeah. Now, these don't happen to be urine. This is boric. No common washing stuff. But if you do this one under a little different magnification, it looks for all the world like one of these gas bursts up in the sky. What do they call those things? You know what I'm talking about?
Nebula.
Yeah. All right. If you do this under a different magnification, this is almost too much. If you do this under smaller magnification, it looks like some of the pictures that you could take up in the saddle would be nice. That's another borax crystal. That's urine. Urea. In this particular form and magnification, it looks like plant life of some kind. I'll show you more of this. These are all mixed up. We were looking at them the other night. They got all mixed up. That's back to borax again. This is done in case any of you are interested by taking certain kinds of crystals called biresurgent crystals that bend light twice, I guess that's what they do. And if you put a polarizing screen in the path of the light that's hitting the slide, and then another one up at the eyepiece, but put them at right angles to each other, they burst into these colors like this. It's splitting up the prism kind of deal in the crystals. These are also borax. And that one. Mm-hmm. Another funny one?
Yeah, it is. It's like the ribbons on
a birthday gift. Like jewels. Zillions of them. In a box of borax. Yeah. This is getting back to some urine again.
No.
I hope you people. What?
Did you add some dye?
No. But this is under great magnification, you understand, and with this cross field polarization.
That's pretty gorgeous. Those are the great things.
What I think happens, and I don't know. I don't care in particular why it happened. I just go for it for the beauty of it. But I guess what probably happens is that by polarizing the light twice in this double refracting kind of a crystal, that you get the thing acting like prism in many different angles and sizes and shapes and all this sort of thing, and it bursts up in all of these colors that go out buried someplace.
Ooh.
That's one of my favorite ones. I like it.
Looks like some of these modernist paintings.
What?
Fantastic painting.
Like an Aztec temple.
Yeah.
Oh, you could use your imagination, or use them like sometimes psychiatrists use projective tests, like Rorschach.
Yeah.
Sit there and really imagine all kinds of things into it. That's urea. I hope you'll think twice before you flush. I've had some artists suggest that they like to take some of these and like this and transfer them on to fabric for dress design and stuff.
What magnification are you?
What?
What magnification?
Oh, I don't know, a lot.
What do you have to have in a lens?
Well, it can't be done by a lens. It's done through a microscope.
Oh.
This is through a polarized microscope?
No. Well, maybe that's what... I've got an old one that you have to do all this stuff too. I think the new ones you don't have to. You got it all built in. There's an old monocular microscope that somebody gave me for free because I didn't have any, didn't know what to do with it. Because the new ones, you know, are binocular, and then if they're going to do photography with them, there's a third tube that so that you can click their camera at exactly what you're seeing while you're seeing it. I have to go through a somewhat more cumbersome process than that. I don't use a lens on the camera at all. The microscope becomes the lens. And this is only a part of what he actually comes up through the microscope because of the way the camera fits on it on a bellows attachment. So there's quite a bit of magnification.